pfwfm.org.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel D.I.s. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
About it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome to The Collision. I'm your host, Chuck Modiano, and we will have co-host Etan Thomas and Dave Zirin with us in a few moments because they will be interviewing Ben Cohen. And if you don't know who Ben Cohen is, that's Ben, and I know you know his first name, Ben of Ben and Jerry's. Ben of Ben and Jerry's, who just about 2 weeks ago was getting arrested in Congress, getting arrested for protesting a genocide. And so we have a full interview in a few minutes with Ben Cohen, Todd and Dave. And he is talking about many things, including his Jewish responsibility that he feels that he has to speak up. And he is also talking about the connections between the money that is spent for that genocide and the money that is not spent at home. And in particular, he makes the connection to lead pipes. He said, if you want to put something in the water to keep a population down for generations on end, it would be lead poisoning. It's a lifelong brain damage, irreversible. We know what causes it and we know how to fix it. But they keep saying we don't have enough money. We have trillions of dollars that we're spending on bombs on Israel alone. So that's what we'll be hearing more from Ben Cohen about that and making that connection and more, or talk about reparations and more. So that's going to be really today's show. Because you want to know why that's going to be today's show? Because I don't want to talk about the Knicks. I don't want to talk about the Knicks right now. They are down 3-1, but they'll come back. Of course, they're going to come back and we're going to see what's going to go on there. In sports also, you have in D.C., the Mystics played very, very well yesterday. And on the future show, we're going to talk more about the Mystics and some of the great young players that we had in D.C. We're going to get into some of those hoops discussions. And we're going to talk even more about Caitlin, but not today. We talk about Caitlin a lot because Caitlin and Angel Reese, it's more than a game. There's a lot going on there, and we're going to talk more about that. But the rest of this show, we'll leave it to Ben and Ben and Jerry's. And before I pass the baton to Magic Mike, all I want to say is this, is that a lot of people are saying, buy Ben and Jerry's. I don't think Ben and Jerry's, they have the ownership like they used to. anymore. When we're talking about that consumerism. So it's really interesting to find out when you have consumerism and find out who owns what. Because Ben and Jerry's doesn't even really fully control Ben and Jerry's. So that happened a few years ago. I think people know about that. So, you know, with that, I hope everyone has a great day. I'm going to pass it to you, Magic Mike. Let's cue up that energy.
Welcome to The Collision. He's Etan Thomas. I'm Dave Zirin, talking to you with somebody who I just cannot believe we're going to talk to. I'm very proud of this moment. We are talking to somebody who was arrested last week at the Capitol in protest of both racialized poverty at home in places like Milwaukee and the U.S.-funded destruction of Gaza by the Israeli armed forces. That alone makes this interview worth your time and certainly our time. But also, this individual, in addition to being a longtime philanthropist and activist, is also the co-founder of my whole family's favorite thing in the fridge, the thing we fight over. I'm talking about, from Ben and Jerry's, Ben Cohen. Ben Cohen, thank you so much for joining us.
Dave, what a beautiful introduction. Thank you.
Just to kick things off, if you could tell us what happened last Wednesday and why you felt the need to take such a step.
I've been hearing about the slaughter in Israel that the U.S. is enabling. That's been kind of driving me crazy. And then I saw an article about another breakout of lead poisoning in Milwaukee. And, you know, the issue of lead poisoning drives me up a wall. I mean, ever since I found out about it when the thing happened in Flint, I looked into it and I researched it and I learned about it. And, there's this expert on lead poisoning, a pediatrician, who says, if you wanted to put something into the water to keep a population down for generations on end, it would be lead. And, it's lifelong brain damage, irreversible. There's nothing you can do about it. And we know what causes it, and we know how to fix it. And we go around saying, oh, yeah, we know how to fix it, but geez, we just don't have enough money. And it's a load of shit. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Of course we've got enough money. I mean, we got trillions of dollars that we're spending on bombs. And, there's two ways that you get lead poisoning. One is from chipping lead paint. That's in the houses and apartments of low-income people. And it would cost like $10 billion to take care of all that, all over the country. And then there's another way that you get lead poisoning is from lead pipes in the water supply. And that would cost like $80 billion to take care of the entire country. And, you know, those numbers, they sound really big until you realize that it's like 1/10 of 1 year's Pentagon budget. And, so if you do it over a period of 5 years, I mean, it's, what is it? I don't know, 2% of the Pentagon budget. It's ridiculous. We have unlimited money to kill people. And, oh, I'm just so sorry. We don't have enough money to take care of our people.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, I've reached my limit. Everybody's got their breaking point. Mm-hmm. And, I wanted to go chain myself to the White House fence. The White House fence has been militarized. You can't get to the White House fence anymore. Mm-hmm. Heavily armed guards. There's a moat. You can't get within I don't know, it looks like 100 feet of the White House fence. And so, you know, the folks I work with suggested that, well, you can disrupt a congressional meeting. And I said, well, gee, I don't know whether that's really going to be effective. And I guess it was. the most effective thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
And Etan, before you go, I just wanted to let our listeners know that Ben Cohen wrote an incredible editorial in Newsweek about the experience and his motivations. We'll be putting that out on our social media feeds so folks can even get a deeper dive. To you, Etan, please.
Sure. I wanted to, before we get into everything that happened, you know, at Congress, I wanted to read one of your tweets. And I thought it was, you know, really profound. And if you could just go into a little bit more depth for me. You said, we are expected to be good Americans and look the other way as Israel prevents food, water, and medicine from reaching the remaining people of Gaza. Israel is literally starving them to death. We must speak out and demand a change in policy. We can't be complicit in starving kids to death.
Mm-hmm.
That was a, you know, very powerful tweet, you know, and just go into a little bit more depth, because I don't know, you know, here in the States, we're not really shown what is really going on the way that we should be by our media. You know, it's viewed as a, you know, as a war, and, you know, not a slaughter, not a genocide, but as, you know, the two sides that are fighting. But let's go into a little bit more detail with your tweet and everything that's going on over there right now.
Yeah, it's not a war. It's a slaughter. You know, I mean, they got these bombers that fly over there and dropping. I mean, I read a statistic. They're dropping 500 tons of bombs per square mile. It's unbelievable. They've dropped more explosive power than the Hiroshima bomb that we dropped. They're totally annihilating a good part of the population and destroying just about every building there, turning Gaza into rubble. And, you know, Gaza was a city. I mean, there was hospitals, schools, universities, not anymore. So, and they're doing it with our money, my money. It drives me up a wall. It's crazy. And you're right, Etan, that they don't want you to see what they're doing. You know, they learned that lesson in Vietnam. We can't let them see the people that we're killing, because, you know, people don't want to kill other people. And you know, I mean, that's not, it's not transparent, like they say they are. It's a cover-up is what I'd call it. I mean, you think about the Iraq war, what was it? Shock and awe. Mm-hmm. And what they showed us was fireworks. You know, oh, look at the beautiful bombs. Oh, yeah, really cool. Fire trails, everything. They don't show you what happens when those bombs hit. It's not a freaking video game.
Right.
It's real people getting burned to death. So, excuse me for going off.
No.
By all means. I wanted to ask you as well. Like you, I'm from New York City. I wasn't raised in Brooklyn, just born there. Like you, I was raised Jewish, and I've always felt that as Jews, we had a responsibility to speak out when the Israeli government engages in these kinds of genocidal activities. Yet far too often, is mainly Israeli Jews or Christian Zionists or whoever, you know, they come down on you like a ton of bricks. Right now we're seeing the weaponization of anti-Semitism to try to shut down entire colleges. What's your perspective? Maybe you could speak a little about that. As a Jew, why you see this issue as having a moral imperative, as well as your thoughts about this weaponization of Judaism?
Well, I mean, for one thing, we recently celebrated Passover, which is about the Jews escaping oppression. And now Israel is the oppressor. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a real conflict. Mm-hmm. And the idea of equating, criticizing the government of Israel with anti-Semitism is absurd. We're not criticizing Jews. We're criticizing the government. Yes, it happens to be a Jewish state, but we're criticizing a particular action of a of the state. And, you know, people criticize particular actions of the United States all the time. I mean, I'm shocked, really, that somehow or other they've been able to make this case, or I don't know, is it a law that it's now considered to be anti-Semitic to criticize Israel? That's a real misunderstanding of what anti-Semitism is.
Yeah.
I mean, anti-Semitism, as I understand it, is hating Jews for being Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't hate Jews for being Jews. I love Jews. Actually, I love Jews, and I also love Jesus Christ. I mean, they tell me he was a Jew. So, I don't know. But you asked a few questions. I don't know if I really answered.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And is anything in your own Jewish upbringing that's also led you to these politics of being anti-war, anti-genocide? Because that's what I see becoming so abused right now, is that I feel like we have a tradition of standing up and they're saying, no, you're wrong. Our tradition is about Israel, you know, at all costs, with no apologies.
Yeah. I mean, my Jewish upbringing was pretty much about how we were oppressed and discriminated against because we were Jews. And that made me feel sympathetic to other minorities that have been oppressed and discriminated against. And, you know, I was opposed to the way Israel was treating Palestinians way before they started bombing them to death. You know, the way they were controlling, they were occupying Palestinian territory in opposition to the United Nations, in opposition to most every other country in the world, in opposition to the International Criminal Court. You know, I mean, I don't know. People don't seem to be able to see it from the other side. I mean, you know, how would you feel, you know, if you were, you know, confined to what the UN calls an open air prison, and you're not able to have a decent life? You're pretty much living in poverty. You need to depend on aid. I mean, something I've never really understood is, you know, say before this recent slaughter, the people in Palestine required all this humanitarian aid, mm-hmm. food, medicine, I don't know, water, whatever it is. And my understanding is that the rest of the world was paying for that aid. I don't understand why Israel wasn't paying for it. I mean, Israel gets to screw these people over and the rest of the world gets to mop up. I don't know. I mean, the U.S. does the same thing. I'm as critical of the U.S. as I am of Israel. I mean, in terms of what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, you know, no justification for slaughtering people in Iraq. And we break it and we expect everybody else to fix it.
You know, one of the things I've, you know, and I started this journey of reading and learning more about everything that's going on in Palestine and Israel and the history of it. This isn't something that just started, on October. It was October 7th or October 9th. This started back in 1948, and even before that. And, you know, it's interesting because it's this. There's this image that I've posted quite a few times. I'll probably post it again. And it's, you know, in a reference to the book, which was one of my favorite books. I got to give a shout out to Ms. Givens in the seventh grade at Carver Middle School for having me read this book. And it's kind of been like the template of everything, called The Animal Farm. And so it's the concept of, you know, at the end, when they looked into the window and they saw the pigs on standing upright and, you know, walking around with clothes on and everything like that and imitating the humans, and all the animals were in shock. And that's where I see as Israel has almost become, it's the tragedy of becoming what you always hated the most, becoming the oppressor. You know, and Israel had, you know, Jews have gone through a tremendous atrocity with the Holocaust. And, you know, learning that history even at a young age. I remember reading Anne Frank, The Diary of Anne Frank, and, you know, visiting Holocaust museums and understanding the history. But then when you're looking at the policies, you're like, wow, well, now you're kind of walking upright. You know what I mean? Like the evil humans. You're doing to another group of people what was done to you. And that is really tragic. Do you see that connection, or do you think that's taking it too far?
No, I totally see it. And it, you know, I mean, what I kind of understand is that both the Palestinians and Israel have a claim to the same piece of land. And I believe that human beings, if they put as much effort into trying to come up with solutions diplomatically as they do into making war, I think they could actually do it. You know, I don't believe that the mothers of children in Palestine, or the mothers of, you know, children in Israel, want to see children in the other country killed. They don't want to see their own kids killed. I think that you know, Israel could have set it up so that people in Palestine were living a good life. We're allowed to prosper, and didn't feel like they were prisoners, and then I think they wouldn't have been so pissed off. I mean, what would we expect, you know, Americans to do if we were occupied? Mm-hmm. We're supposed to cooperate and lie down.
You're right, and it's the notion of you coming in and taking somebody's land and then telling them they have to go live in the basement, you know, or it doesn't seem like it should be that difficult to understand. And when you start bringing up the atrocities, okay, well, should Israel even be there in the first place? like, are they occupying this? Like, well, it's complicated. That's one thing that I've heard so much. And it doesn't really sound that complicated to me. You know, I mean, I'm looking at the facts and rolling. I was like, well, y'all are saying this is so complicated. It doesn't seem like it's as complicated. You took the land and now you're slaughtering them. And now you want to take more land.
I don't know. I think it is complicated. You know, and I think the Palestinians' beef might actually be with the UK. I mean, my understanding is that, I mean, at the end of World War II, you know, the Jews were being systematically exterminated. They needed a homeland where they could feel safe. And my understanding, and I could certainly be wrong, is that, you know, the United Kingdom had control over that area of land, what's now Israel and Palestine. And some, you know, the world leaders made a decision that the Jewish homeland was going to be where Israel currently is. I mean, I don't know. So that decision was made, I think, not by Israel, because Israel didn't exist.
Well, it's definitely true that like numerous locations were discussed in so far as resettlement, which also gives lie to the idea of Israel, where it currently is, being affixed in our mind as this eternal homeland. That's our land by right, because they were looking at Guyana. They were looking at parts of Alaska. I mean, there were proposals out there for a Jewish state. And yes, yeah, the Balfour Resolution, the taking of that land and invisibilizing or just lessening the humanity of the people who lived there. And by the way, the people who lived there were from all religions too. Like a small but significant number of Jews. I mean, before the State of Israel, you had a Palestine where people did live alongside one another. And yet what you had then was, after World War II, okay, the Jews are going to resettle there. And then you get the Nakba, which we just passed the anniversary of, which was Jewish militias with, of course, England and the world looking in the other direction, violently and physically depopulating the land. And that's what makes the demand of the movement so strong, is they've always said that they want the right to return, which the UN has sanctified as a human right. And yet when it comes to Palestinians, like with so many human rights, they're left on the outside looking in.
Yeah. I mean, I personally believe that Israel has a right to exist. And but I think they have a responsibility to treat their neighbors with humanity and kindness. So now, you know, I can hear, you know, Jews in Israel saying, well, you know, they were exploding suicide bombs in cafes and stuff like that. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I can tell you what the answer is not. And it's not murdering and slaughtering and destroying a civilization. Yeah.
Let me say real quick, the term Israel has a right to exist, but I never hear, you know, Palestine has a right to exist.
Well, and I believe Palestine has a right to exist.
But it has to go hand in hand. And that's the issue, that it always stops at Israel has a right to exist, or Israel has a right to defend itself. Never Palestine has a right to defend itself, or Palestine has a right to exist, or Palestine has a right to be treated as human beings. It's only Israel, and it's that language that then makes the good guys bad guys, the divide in the way that we're being shown the issue is being broadcast here in the States. And it's never, you know, whether you're looking at politics, and it's on both sides. It's not just on one side. It's both of them have the same exact language, and they'll say that the phrase Israel has the right to defend itself, Israel has the right to exist. never Palestine has a right to exist, or Palestine.
I appreciate you bringing that up, Eitan, because I'm going to start changing my language. I'm going to say Palestine has a right to exist and Israel has a right to exist.
I think this discussion has, I think, turned a lot of people on to the idea that a lot of us really are wrestling with big questions, but the immediate question of stopping the bombing, stopping the withholding of food, like, we have to get those right or there won't be a Palestine to save. And we already,
that's what they're trying to do. I mean,
yeah, they're trying to make it utterly uninhabitable.
I mean, they're not hiding it. I mean, right. I was just looking at some quotes from Netanyahu and their defense minister, whatever. I mean, they're saying we're going to completely expel the Palestinians mm-hmm. from this land. It's going to become our land. And what the latest thing is, we're going to ship a million of them to what, Libya or something?
Libya is what they said. This is unbelievable. The forced depopulation of people, what Jews suffered time and again, what brought my family to this country is right. now being perpetrated on another people. It's nauseating. Ben Cohen, what advice do you have for people who want to get involved, who want to do something? I know so many people who are just looking at this and smashing their phones on their desks. What can people do, do you think?
You know, there's a group that I'm familiar with called Win Without War that's been doing a lot of work on this. I would get in touch with those guys. They're, you know, visit their website. And I think it really helps to call your congressperson. It doesn't help to email them. It doesn't help to do anything else. But if you call them, that definitely makes a difference. And I think if letters to the editor in your local paper, because your local congressman reads those, mm-hmm. they keep track of that because they want to get reelected.
Let me go back to something, because I wanted to just present this when we were talking about, you know, originally when the entire world after everything that happened to the Holocaust decided that that is the land. There, and you said that there was a lot of different, you know, pieces of land that was considered. Never was it considered Germany. Help me understand why, you know, you would punish someone that has absolutely nothing to do what happened to you, but not punish the group that, even if they, if everybody wasn't complicit in it, some people look the other way. So it happened in Germany. Why would Germany be the ones that are punished, or carving out a piece of land there? Like, help me out with that.
You know, it makes sense. I mean, I could kind of understand how the Jews might not want to hang out around Germany, but I think you're right. I think that the country that creates the problem ought to have to create the solution.
Of course.
Yeah, ought to own it, yeah.
Well, and Germany itself, I mean, I think they've really done a good job of atoning for that sin. You know, it's interesting. My wife has a mother, like most wives do, who was in a ghetto, and she happened to escape. But the German government, I mean, she's 96 now. The German government pays her reparations. And, you know, I mean, I visited Germany a few times and talked to the people there. An amazing job of, you know, just making the people who live there aware of what, Germany did under the Nazis. And, you know, they're all you know, apologetic. I mean, they're embarrassed. They're ashamed. And, you know, which is kind of as it should be. I mean, they're ashamed for their country. I mean, the people I were talking to, you know, weren't alive, you know, during the time of the Nazis, but they're, you know, they didn't sweep it under the rug. They owned up to it. Unlike what's going on right now in the U.S., I mean, Trump is saying, scrub any part of the history, scrub any part of the museum, scrub any part of the education curriculum that does not make kids think that America is the greatest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell them the truth. No. I mean, we got problems right here in River City.
Yeah.
When you let me jump in real quick. When you're talking about, and you said the, you know, as far as reparations, you know, I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that's the home of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And, you know, none of the descendants or victims have received any reparations, as if, you know, all around the country. We still have, you know, Miss Viola Fletcher just celebrated a birthday, and she is the last living member from the Tulsa Race Massacre. She's still living right now. So when I hear Trump say, you know, or I hear different, you know, people from the right and, you know, Republicans say, well, that's so far removed, we can't even talk about reparations. Reparations can't even be on the table. When you have not only just descendants, but actual people who were there when this atrocity happened, still living right now, it's frustrating that that's never on the table. And it should be. And as you just said, your wife's mother right now, you know, in Germany is paying, you know, reparations and atoning for everything like that. And that's not even on the table for America to do. That's a frustrating fact.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, it's interesting. I was talking with one interviewer, you know, about the issue of generational wealth. The generational wealth gap between white people and black people. And he was saying, you know, and an example I was giving was, you know, that my family bought a house using a government loan program in the 1950s. And that government loan program redlined and would not loan into black areas. And if a black person wanted to get around that and get a loan for a house in a white area, they wouldn't do that either, because they said, well, then that makes it a black area.
Mm.
And that was official U.S. government policy in writing. And so I pointed out that that has, I mean, you know, a house is how people, that's how people get equity. That's how they start building equity. That's how they start achieving some degree of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was saying that, you know, that's one of the reasons for this generational wealth gap. And he's saying, well, that was back a long time ago. You know, I mean, that's, you're talking about the 1950s. I mean, this is today. And how can what happened in the 1950s affect people today? You know, he didn't get it. But yeah, it's generations. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we talk about it in, you know, in the business world, you know, somebody wants to start a small business and, you know, the first investments that you get are friends and families. And, you know, white people have friends and families that can give them some money to help them out to start. And because they've got that generational wealth, and Black people don't have it, not near as much.
Well, you know, especially as the generational wealth, when you trace back where it came from, you know, especially here in America, when you're dealing with the North and the South, it's always tied to slavery. And yes, slavery is the reason why there is such a wealth gap, where Black people were not allowed to own anything. You know,
because they were owned.
Right. So the even the notion that that only happened in the South is false. Because you go all through the North and you trace back to where this generational wealth started, it's all stemmed, you know, from slavery. And that's part of knowing that history, and why it's so, you know, it's so impactful that Trump is trying so hard to erase that history, to dispel any type of racial inequity, inequality, or anything else, because he says, oh, you know, but the part that is not amazing, but the amount of people who then buy into it to say, yes, there is no, you know, and that's, there's so many correlations to what was going on in Germany to what Trump is doing right now.
Yes.
And I don't think enough people are making that correlation.
Well, I was just reading some article that said, we're two professors, we study fascism, we're leaving the country, we're going to Canada. Mm.
You mean the 51st state? I'm not sure Canada's going to be that safe. Shove comes to push. Maybe look at some New Zealand properties, but... Yeah, these are very challenging times, certainly. And I think the Germany U.S. slave system comparison is very, very important for two reasons. One, it acknowledges both the transatlantic slave trade and its after effects as a genocide, which this country does not want to do, because there are practical implications to that. And then two, you do the compare and contrast, and frankly, it's embarrassing. Like, they take extra effort in German schools to talk about the sins of Nazism. Meanwhile, we have schools named after Confederate generals. So it's completely in a different approach. I mean, if Germany did their history the way the U.S. does their history, there would be Adolf Hitler statues all over Germany, and you'd have to accept that. And then you have to ask, then, like, they say protests for Palestinian rights make Israeli students feel uncomfortable. It's like, who gets to feel comfortable and who doesn't get to feel comfortable is another part of this whole question. And why we privilege groups over others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, Mr. Cohen, Ben. can you take us through everything that happened in Congress when you got arrested? Just walk us through everything that happened, because it was such a powerful scene and such a powerful statement. So I really have to commend you for it. But walk us through everything that happened.
Sure. So I said I want to chain myself to the gate. My people said, you know, that stupid idea. And they said, what we're going to do is we're going to set up a press conference in front of the Capitol. And then after that, a few people will go off and disrupt a congressional hearing. I was one of the co-founders of an organization called the Eisenhower Media Network, which is a group of retired military officers, an admiral, a general, and a bunch of colonels, and some people from the intelligence community, so one of those there was a woman, Josie, who is one of those veterans. And she organized this press conference. We had a bunch of vets. We had a bunch of doctors, some religious leaders, a couple of Congress people, and myself. Mm-hmm. So we had that press conference, and then, you know, somewhere in the middle of it, you know, a few of us melted off, as we were told to do, to go to this congressional hearing. And then they said, there's been a problem. We can't get into the congressional hearing, so that part of it is over. So we're starting to walk away. And then they said, well, we think we can get you in. So, I went in, and we're walking along, going to the hearing room, and I'm saying, when am I supposed to get up and disrupt? And they said, well, there'll be some other people in there that are also going to be disrupting. So when they disrupt, you disrupt.
Okay. Right.
What am I supposed to say? Well, you know, say something about, Medicaid and the bombing of Gaza. And, so I'm trying to figure out, you know, how to put those two together. I'm trying to come up with some wording that would be short and effective. Mm-hmm. And we end up going into this hearing room, and I had no idea what hearing room it was. I had no idea what committee was there. And I'm sitting there, in the spectators, section, and I'm looking in front of me, and, there's Bernie Sanders, and, next to him is the Republican head of the committee, and the Republican starts giving his, introductory remarks, and then Bernie starts giving his, and then, Bobby Kennedy walks in. So I figured out that this must be the Health and Human Services Committee, and somebody behind me started getting up and yelling something. And so I got up and yelled that, Congress is buying bombs and giving them to Israel to kill kids and taking the money from Medicaid for poor kids in the U.S. Uh-huh. And then they, came and dragged me out of there and handcuffed us. There were about six of us. We're walking down the hall to get to the paddy wagon. And there were some people from Code Pink that were prompting me with questions as I'm walking down to get me to say, what I had said. And then they prompted me to talk about the starvation. And they were videoing at the same time. And then we ended up next to the paddy wagon, and then they searched each one of us very intensely and stuck us in the paddy wagon. I was really impressed that the paddy wagon was air conditioned. I'd been in a paddy wagon before, and it was never air conditioned. And there's a wall down the middle of it that separates the boys from the girls, and I was on one side with a guy, and I think there were four women on the other side, and the guy who was on my side, he was, I was going to say he was an older fellow, but I guess I'm an older fellow. He was a contemporary. And, he had had a bunch of joint replacements, knees and hips and stuff. And he had a very hard time getting into the paddy wagon. I mean, the police were good. They didn't, they didn't use excessive force. They were concerned about this guy that was having a hard time getting in. Then they drove us to the there's a special Capitol Police, and they have their own special station. They drove us there, and we hung out in some room, and one by one, they kind of called us into another room, asked us a bunch of questions, and then sat us down somewhere, searched us again, and eventually they said, well, they charged me, they said, pay $50 and you can go. So I did.
That's ridiculous.
This last question, I'll start wrapping this up, but how has the backlash been, or support? How has that support been? Because I'm sure you have, a lot of both been since that day.
I guess, I don't really look at social media. if people are dumping on me on social media, I'm not aware of it. I guess I did see a little of the, flamers, but I really don't follow it. But in terms of email and text, it's all been incredibly positive. I mean, I heard from people I haven't heard from in 10 or 20 years. Part of the exhausting part of this thing was just trying to respond to everybody that was, congratulating me, wishing me well, and, just saying how much they supported and agreed with what I did. I mean, it struck a chord. It was, the right place, the right time, the right words. Code Pink people did a great job of catching that video. And, I just heard that the video got like 15 million views.
Jeez.
And I heard that the biggest tweet that Ben and Jerry's ever put out got 9 million views. So it was huge. I've never experienced anything like that.
Wow. Well, Ben Cohen, Ben, as we say here on The Collision, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. It's truly, it's been a pleasure and an honor. And I think an example for so many people that they don't just have to be mad. They don't just have to stew, that they can find something to do to push back against this terrible tide.
Yeah. It's been great being on with you guys. I've never met Etan in 3D, and I just met you for the first time, Dave. And one of these days, we should get together in three dimensions. It would be
love it.
It would be nice. Keep in touch. I mean, I don't know. I just have a real feeling of simpatico and closeness with you guys. And
hey. At Baseline, if you're ever in the D.C. area, we will be there to see you.
Oh, is that where both of you guys are located?
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I get there every now and then.
We could have bailed you out.
Yeah, right. and let me just say this before we go. I've told Dave this a lot of times. I've told Chuck Modiano this a lot of times. I'll tell you, it's even more important for Jewish people to speak out about the injustice and atrocities of the state of Israel. And it means a lot. And it was really, really amazing seeing in New York and DC in particular, the amount of Jewish organizations that American Jews that were letting their voices be heard, letting their objections be heard, letting them know that, no, this does not represent Judaism. You're not going to do this in our name and have us all go along with it and say just all Jews are supposed to feel the same exact way, that this is correct. And that really does mean a lot. So I just wanted to encourage you to keep using your voice. You are a celebrity. I know you don't consider yourself a celebrity, but you are definitely a celebrity. and you have a powerful voice. And the reason why, you know, when you made that statement and when you, you know, took that stance, why it got 15 million views, because of who you are. You are the co-owners and co-founders of Ben and Jerry's. You know what I mean? And so it's really important. So much respect to you, and please continue to use your voice. And thanks again, you know, for coming on The Collision. We really appreciate it.
Well, a lot of respect to you guys too.
All right. Thank you.
Come up, visit in Vermont one of these days.
Hey, what are you, Burlington?
It's nice in the summer.
Atan, let's put a pin in that one, sir.
Let's do it.
Vermont is amazing. A lot of big dogs, but otherwise very nice.
All right.
Sounds good.
Go Knicks.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Freedom!
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 23rd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th, at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with films such as the U.S. premiere of Fanon and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th. Information at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
You must learn.
Peace. Hashtag You Must Learn is your Thursday at 6 p.m. Liberatory Educational Radio Show, and we mourn the April 25th passing of the educational giant, Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu. So the Hashtag You Must Learn Collective is hosting a four-hour special program honoring Dr. Kanjufu on Thursday, May 29th from 3 to 7 p.m. We're going to have legendary elders who work directly with him, as well as juggernaut educators who were inspired by Dr. Kanjufu to reflect on his life. That's right, a four-hour special program honoring Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu on Thursday, May 29th from 3 to 7 p.m. Tune into this special program as WPFW builds a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Oh, what a lovely, precious dream.
WPFW, in collaboration with the Josephine Butler Center, present the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. An activation of music, poetry, social justice teach-ins, visual art, wellness, children's activities, and more in Malcolm X Park. WPFW personalities Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaba Soul Singer, and Proverbs Reggae Band will be among the performers, with sets by DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog. Also featured will be an art show curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise and a community curated by Milani Douglas. Stay tuned to WPFW for updates and details.
On Saturday, May 31st and Sunday, June 1st, Capital Bop partners with Sycamore and Oak to present Jazz in the Heights, two full days of music in the Congress Heights neighborhood, featuring artists from D.C., Baltimore, and beyond. This two-day festival of jazz and culture will include appearances by Chelsea Green and the Green Project, Burkhead, the Desron Douglas Quartet, Deborah Bond, and more. Details at capitalbop.com or sycamoreandoak.com.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly five decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.